From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with Hollywood legend Lauren Bacall. We'll talk about her movies and her marriage to her first leading man, Humphrey Bogart. In her new book, Now, she writes about her life as a single older woman. We excerpted this interview last month. We have the complete version for you today. And Arnold is back in Junior, a new film which also stars Danny DeVito and Emma Thompson. Stephen Schiff has a review of this new comedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we have the complete version of an interview with Lauren Bacall, which we excerpted last month during a national fundraising week.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Everyone was knocked out by the 19-year-old Lauren Bacall when she made her screen debut in the 1944 film To Have and Have Not. 1 year later, she married her leading man, Humphrey Bogart. They were married for more than 11 years when Bogart died of cancer. Their screen lives together included the films The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo. Bacall appeared in other films such as Young Man with a Horn, How to Marry a Millionaire, Designing Woman, The Shootist, and Misery. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new satire of the fashion world, Prêt-à-Porter, which is scheduled to open next month. Bacall wrote about her life in her 1978 autobiography, By Myself, which won a National Book Award. In her new book, called Now, she reflects on her life now as an older, single woman. She says that the way people perceive her as tough and strong has been a thorn in both her sides.
Well, the perception has always been that I am in control and that I can handle any situation and that I'm very independent and don't need anyone and I'm very strong and strong-willed and nobody tells me what to do. Well, it's wrong. I mean, it's totally incorrect. I am, I guess I am dictatorial to a degree, but I certainly am not, I'm not tough and I'm not easily led, but I'm not in control of every situation by a long shot. And I need the same things that most women need. And I am sensitive to the kind of criticism and kind of pigeonholing that they tend to do with people like me, myself. And so, I mean, I think the people have confused what I am with some of the parts I've played. And I certainly am not tough.
One of the themes of your new memoir now is that you're a woman on your own.
Yes.
You're not married. You live alone. And you seem to have a love-hate relationship with that kind of independence. Tell me a little bit about what you love and what you hate about it.
Yes, well, it's true. I do have a love-hate relationship with it, but I think I love it more than I hate it, for the most part. It's, I enjoy the quiet of being alone. Because in my work, I'm always with a lot of people. And so it's a kind of a relief to me at the end of an evening to just come, let down everything, you know, just let go and just kind of relax and wander around my apartment and go make a cup of tea or do whatever I want to do. And I like morning silence. And I, of course, one gets very spoiled. I enjoy, you know, doing what I want to do when I want to do it. If I feel like taking off and going on a trip, I do. I don't have to consult anyone. But it's a rather selfish way to live, in actual fact. And what I miss, and I don't miss it all the time, but I do miss it from time to time, is the ability to share the wonderful times or the happy times or the successful times, or however you want to categorize it, with someone. I also miss the constant search for having somebody that I want to spend an evening with to go to an event with me, because I usually do go with a pair of my friends.
Now, you can't probably go to a lot of places by yourself because...
Oh, no, well, women can't anyway. Still, in these days of feminism and equal rights, you still women are kind of frowned upon walking into bars alone. I wouldn't go to a bar anyway, but I mean...
Was it harder or easier when you're Lauren Bacall to go someplace alone?
Well, I think it's harder because I think you're not anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not complaining about that because, I mean, I'm not interested in wandering about anyway too much. It doesn't amuse me, but I don't, you know, I don't like to spend my time that way anyway, but...
Do you have a lot of friends who are single?
Not many. No, most of my friends are couples, in actual fact, and that's difficult. Now, there are some of my couple friends who are great about my being, you know, an extra person, and they never think about it. And then there are others who just automatically think in terms of another couple. That doesn't mean that they think less of me. It's just that... It seems to be our society, you know. Let's the four of us meet for dinner and let's the four of us go to the theater. And, you know, that's the way people generally think in America, much more than in Europe.
Now, you have a new movie that's coming out very soon called Prêt-à-Porter, which is directed by Robert Altman, set in the French fashion industry.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen it yet.
No.
Tell us a little bit about your part.
Well... I play an ex-editor of Vogue who has spent most of her life in the fashion world and who comes to Paris this time with a Texas cowboy bootmaker to try to sell his boots to one of the designers. And that bootmaker is played by Lyle Lovett. And then what ensues, you know, there are so many different stories. It's a gigantic cast.
It's an Altman film, of course.
But this is even bigger than most of his films. And it's, I don't know, I understand. I haven't seen it yet, but I understand it's really very good. And he seems very happy with it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Does he direct you differently than other directors you've worked with?
Oh, yes.
What's different?
Well, by the nature of the fact that there are so many people involved to begin with, it's different. And especially on this movie, because in Paris, he has a problem with the language. And we had a French crew and lots of crowds, and their method of working is different. So he was a little more removed from the actors than he normally is because of all of that. But also, you know, with Bob, you wear a mic all the time. So all through the scene, you're mic'd. And he is apt to pick up all sorts of remarks. And he'll use some of them. And you forget that you have it on, you know, because you're wearing it all day.
So what kind, was anything picked up that you were surprised at?
Well, I don't
know.
Because
you haven't seen it yet.
No. But he, that's the way he works. He likes to work. He likes overlapping. He doesn't want that clean dialogue where one actor stops and the other one starts. And he's right, because Bob's work always has reflected life. Different aspects of life in America and or the world, depending upon the subject. And he in life, one doesn't, people talk at the same time. And he likes that. He uses it. And it's always worked well for him.
Lauren Bacall is my guest, and her new memoir is called Now. Here we are on radio listening to your voice. And, I mean, your voice is one of the kind of special voices from film. And you have a deep voice. I'm wondering if you were ever self-conscious about your voice before realizing what an asset it was. Was your voice deep when you were a teenager?
Yes. Yes, it always has been deep. I've always had a low voice. My mother had one, and my daughter has one.
Did you like it when before you were
I don't think I ever thought about it, you see. In actual fact, I have never been one, even from childhood, to kind of analyze myself very much. I just don't try to figure it all out to any degree. And my voice has been somewhat of a drawback now over the years, because there are people, first of all, we won't discuss, if I pick up the phone, they say, yes, sir, you know. I say, yes, and I am not a sir, and they keep saying, yes, sir. We know, sir. Nobody listens. And also, I think it's one of the reasons that the perception of me has been that I'm so in control and so strong, so tough, because I have this deep voice. But I can't. I don't want to change it, and I can't change it.
On the first film that you made, To Have and Have Not, your voice was really quite outstanding. You used it to great effect. Now, when Howard Hawks, the director of that film, first noticed you, he probably had no idea what your voice was like, because he first saw you on the cover of Harper's Bazaar. He was attracted by your look and had no idea what your voice was like.
Right. That's true.
What did he say when he first heard your voice?
Well, I don't know what he said when he first heard it, but he used to... Howard was a fascinating man, because he used to... I didn't know how to drive a car, and he used to pick me up and take me to a studio or wherever he was taking me, and we would have lunch and so forth, and he would tell me about scenes with different actresses when he was directing Carol Lombard in 20th Century, or when he was directing Jean Arthur in Only Angels Have Wings, or Rita Hayworth, or whoever he was directing, whatever woman he was directing, he would always tell me these stories. His fantasy was always to find an unknown girl and make her a star. His Svengali instincts were very ripe. And he, the only thing that he wanted me to do, excuse me, was to keep my voice at a low register in the middle of an emotional scene of any kind, because normally in an emotional scene, when you're emotional, your voice tends to rise, and he didn't want mine to rise. And so he had this vision, and he told me about it. He wanted me to keep my voice down for all of those scenes that required either anger or excitement or any scene that would normally provoke a rise in your voice. He wanted it to be kept down. So he liked it, and it could not be low enough to suit him. Something in his head, you see. I mean, he had this dream.
Well, you say he really wanted to make you into his version of the ideal woman. What was that ideal?
Well, that ideal was a woman who could give as good as she got, who had humor, who was kind of a woman of the world and somewhat insolent, and actually who behaved rather like a man.
What did that mean, to behave rather like a man?
Well, that you would look, if a man said something to you, you would look at him directly. And he didn't like shy wallflower types. And always with humor, though, and always somewhat suggestive that something was in the offing, something could happen. And you weren't quite sure what that something was, but you knew that it would be fun and fascinating and probably different, unusual. I mean, he had this incredible thing going on in his brain, and it worked, because I was insolent, and he always said he wanted someone as insolent as Bogart.
Did you find that kind of woman appealing?
Appealing?
Yeah.
Oh yes, kind of fascinating, adventurous, and I mean, when you are playing a part like that, where you have traveled, I mean, you begin to think, God, what a great life. Independent and living alone, and how dramatic. I was so stage-struck and star-struck and everything-struck that I loved the idea of adventure and the drama of everything was so appealing to me. I mean, that was the fun of acting to me, that I could lose myself in all of that stuff.
You had something that was described as the look. I mean, your eyes were kind of droopy, and you'd look at people with your head lowered a little bit.
Yes, and I'd look up at them.
Yeah, so describe the look a little bit
more.
Chin
on chest.
And how you got it.
Well, I was terribly nervous during To Have and Have Not. It was quite a terrifying experience for me, and I was this kid, and I was scared to death of all these pros around me, and really had almost no experience on the stage. And certainly none in film. So I was shook when Hawk said action and there was quiet on the set. I'd start to walk into a scene and then my head would shake and my hands would shake. And I discovered that if I kept my head down and looked up, my head would not shake. So I started to do that when I could, when it was appropriate in a scene. And that's how the look came about. But it wasn't that I had planned to have a look. It was just that it was a way to keep my head steady, and that was very important. Terrible to look at another actor while your head is shaking.
Lauren Bacall is my guest. She's written a new memoir called Now. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Lauren Bacall is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Now. I think a lot of people have been a little disappointed by life and by love because they compare it to what they've seen in the movies, and it never quite measures up to the movie version. Before you ever really experienced love, you were acting out the movie version of romance, and then you started having the romance with the person who you were acting it out with on screen. And I guess I'm really wondering if there was anything disappointing about the real-life version of it, even though it was the same two people who were doing it on screen.
No, you mean if there was any disappointment in my marriage, in my life with
no,
Bogey,
in the early romance of
the
it.
The early romance was the most romantic experience I have ever had in my life, far surpassing anything that I might have dreamed of or imagined. It was quite amazing. I mean, when you are young and when it's your first love and you are just carried away by it and when that's all you can think about. And you see, Bogey was the kind of man who believed in taking care of a marriage and taking care of a relationship. He believed you had to work at it and keep it fresh and fun and interesting, and he did.
He was already a movie star to you, right?
Oh, yes,
when you worked
absolutely.
Together. So you had a sense of him as an icon as well as
no,
a man.
No, not as an icon. He was not my favorite movie star.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Yes, he knew it. No, Leslie Howard was my favorite. Uh-huh. He knew that. But he had worked with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest, which is funny, you know. No, he wasn't an icon when I met him. I mean, because it was after Casablanca, and he was a big star, but certainly not what he is today, which is this legend, this incredible icon now. I mean, he is bigger than ever.
I'm sure you've been asked this a zillion times, but do you think that what you and Bogart were feeling off screen, you can see on screen? I mean, that the real relationship registers in the
movie? Well, I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly the chemistry registers, whether it is a consummated relationship or not. I think if there is chemistry between two people, you feel it. I think that Bogey and myself in To Have and Have Not, I think having fallen in love with one another, finally, I think, first of all, it was great for me because it gave him, he wanted me to be good in it, so he made it much easier for me to play the scenes. And of course, my feeling, you know, the feeling was so strong that, you know, originally in To Have and Have Not, his character was supposed to have a little flirtation with the other woman. And once Hawks saw the rushes of the scenes that Bogey and I had played, Bogey said to him, nobody is ever going to accept or believe that he would go off with anybody else for a second. And it was true.
When you and Bogart decided to get married, you write that he said to you that he wanted to marry you, but only if you were willing to give up going on location for a film because he didn't want you both going off in different directions.
Right.
How do you feel about that in retrospect?
Well, I recognize the fact completely that separation does not breed a happy marriage. I think you must be together. I mean, the reason you get married is to be together, not to be separated. And I think particularly in my profession, but in any profession, I think if you each go off in opposite directions, sooner or later, one of you is going to go off and not come back. And I think that's natural. I agreed to his terms.
But you wanted so much to be an actress.
Right.
And this cut down on the roles that you could take.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I never even got the offers because I was thought of as Bogey's wife and then I would just go with him on location, which I did. And we were never separated. We were separated once only for a very short time.
Well, you know, I was thinking how and what frustrating it must have been when he was making African Queen with Katharine Hepburn. You were there in Africa with them, kind of suffering through through all of the problems they had to suffer through. But I mean, you were there as the wife. And
I was there as the wife. I was
not
in charge
as the star.
Of lunch. No, right.
So
no,
how
but
did
you know,
feel?
I had a lot of frustrations mm-hmm. about my career.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, times where I felt I should have been considered for a part that I wasn't considered for. Bogey had decided early on and told me from the very beginning that he would never interfere with my career, that whatever I did professionally, I would do only with myself and my agent. If I wanted his advice, I could ask him, but that he would never step in, and he never did. And sometimes I thought, well, he ought to step in. I mean, once in a while, I should be in a movie with him that one of the parts is... But whatever his decision was, he was correct because he'd had enough experience to know what worked and what didn't work. And I was very frustrated at times, but I still believe, and I even believed then, that even throughout my frustration, that the choice I made was the right one. Obviously, in view of what happened, it most certainly was the right one. And I'm really happy that I made that choice.
Because your life together was
short. Well, because
so short.
He had a life. He had a life that he never thought he would have. And it was very short. But imagine if I'd gone off somewhere. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have stood for it anyway, so.
After his death, how did that change for you the life you wanted for yourself professionally?
Well, unfortunately, it didn't change very much because, you know, when people get in the habit of not seeing you very much on screen, that habit kind of carries over. And I played in a movie that was very mediocre.
Which movie?
What was it called? I forgot. With Robert Stack, about the little girl with the horse and the gift of love. Wasn't very good. It was a remake, and it wasn't a good remake. And then I went to Europe to be in a movie in England, and India, which of course I loved. And that movie was quite a good movie, but my career never. You see, then I had to leave California. There was no life for me there. And so my career then shifted to the stage. Then, of course, they don't think about you at all in movies.
Right, because you're outside.
Oh, no. Oh, she wants to be in the theater. Oh, who cares? We're on to the next.
So what did you do to make it clear that you wanted back in?
Well, I just think if you just keep hang in there, you know, and just keep working in one medium or another, I have still not gotten my choice of the best roles in the world. There are still friends that don't think of me for parts because we're friends. Well, I mean, that's life. And that's the biz.
Lauren Bacall. She's written a new memoir called Now. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Lauren Bacall will be back in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Lauren Bacall talks about some of the people she's worked with or known well, like Marilyn Monroe, John Wayne, and Frank Sinatra. It's part two of our conversation with Bacall. And action hero Arnold Schwarzenegger is trying comedy again. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Junior. It co-stars Emma Thompson and Danny DeVito. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress Lauren Bacall, the star of such films as To Have and Have Not, The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, Key Largo, How to Marry a Millionaire, Designing Woman, and The Shootist. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new film about the French fashion industry called Prêt-à-Porter, which opens next month. Bacall has written a new memoir called Now.
I want to ask you about working with some of the many people you've worked with
over the years
and see if you could share some of your impressions of them. Faulkner wrote the script or co-wrote the script for your first two movies. Did you work with him directly?
Well, not really, but I saw him a lot because he was in Hawks' office all the time. And I remember in The Big Sleep one day he came on the set with a scene that he had written. And Hawks, of course, brought it over and showed it to Bogey and me. And what he had done was he had written a speech that was 2 pages long for one character. Now, that's the way he wrote. But you couldn't, on a movie screen, have one person talking for that length of time. Hawks just thought it was great. He thought it was kind of funny. But I got to know Faulkner when we were in Italy. He was there, and we would see him. He was a shy, brilliant, and really charming, charming man. And if you ever get a chance to find to read his Nobel Prize speech, it was a most amazing talk. He had quite a mind, quite an exceptional mind, and he was an adorable little man because you know he had a big drinking problem, and he would say, we saw him in Rome, and we said, what are you going to do now, Bill? He said, well, I thought that I would drive down to the south, tasting the wine of the country as I go.
You work with Marilyn Monroe on mm-hmm. How to Marry a Millionaire. How was the experience of working with her?
It was fine. I mean, we got along very well. My only complaint about her was that she was late all the time. But she was late out of fear as much as anything else. But it was hard to sit around and wait, you know. But she was usually an hour or two late every morning.
You strike me as such different types, probably off the screen, certainly on the screen.
Oh, yes, we are. I mean, I wish I had been as photogenic as she was. But she was a very kind of sweet, kind of far away, very self-involved, but not, I mean, she had no meanness. She was not bitchy. She was not strident in any way. She was just always seemed a little lost to me, wistful kind of, but just kind of not quite there. Do you know what I mean? And you'd be playing a scene with her, and she would go over and over the scene, and you'd have to be on your toes because she'd do many, many takes. And she always had the coach on the set, which was a big annoyance, you know, that's constantly, instead of looking at you, she'd be looking at the coach. That kind of thing was difficult. But personally, she really was sweet. I mean, we did get along well.
Kirk Douglas. Now, he was your boyfriend before you even...
I had such a crush on him. Oh, he was so dazzling when I was 15 and he was 115. No. And he was... God, he was attractive. And I just took one look at him and I was sunk.
This is when you were in high school or right after high school?
I was at the American Academy. I was 15 years old. I was just enamored of him. And he was pretty dashing and dazzling, wonderful, wonderful actor. And, of course, I was involved in his beginning, which was when Hal Wallace... Is that the story you want?
Well, Young Man with a Horn? Is that what you're thinking?
No. When Bogey and I were going on the train to New York once, Hal Wallace was on the train with us, and Kirk was in a play in New York with a small part. And I told Hal about him. I said, you better go see this guy. He's a wonderful actor. And Hal did, and then signed him. And that's how his career started in pictures.
No. After being a boyfriend and girlfriend when you were very young, what was it like to be in a movie with him in Young Man with a Horn?
Well, it was great. It was fun because, first of all, each of us had other lives by then.
Right.
And we were very secure in our own lives. But, of course, when you remember those times, it's kind of fun. You know, you have that kind of little flirtation going on that doesn't really mean anything, but it just all has to do with the past.
John Wayne, you worked with him in two movies, Storm Warning in the 50s.
No, Blood Alley. Yeah.
Oh, Blood Alley. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's what I mean. Blood Alley in the 50s. And then The Shootist in, was it 75, 76?
77.
Okay. And that The Shootist was his last movie, and he had cancer in real life and also in the movie.
Off that,
and the character
screen,
was, you know, an aged gunfighter who was dying of cancer. I'm wondering what it was like then, knowing that he was really sick, that would probably be his last movie, not wanting to kind of over-dramatize the significance of that, but here he is playing out the drama on screen that's happening off screen, and you know what's happening, but you don't want to get too...
Well, you couldn't with him.
Mm-hmm.
I learned through Bogey's illness that the person who is ill is the one who dictates your behavior.
Right, right. You take your cues from them.
Right. And Bogey never discussed it and never talked about it once after his surgery. And so I never did.
Mm-hmm.
And
you never
Duke
talked
was
about
the
it together?
No. And, you know, we say some days, you know, I don't feel so good today, or I have to do this, you know, I have to go have this radiation or what, you know, stuff like that. But, I mean, he never talked to me about if something happens or what might, you know, never. Now, Duke was the same. Duke never talked about it. I mean, mind you, I wasn't married to him, but he still, we knew each other fairly well and never talked about it. And he handled himself impeccably. Well, you have to go along with that. You know, he was, he was very strange contradiction of a man to me because he, of course, politically we didn't agree about anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were really on opposite sides. And vehemently so we never discussed it, obviously. But we worked very well together. And he was sweet with me, and he was really attractive, you know. He had a quality that surprised me, that he did have a kind of a real appeal. I mean, there was a reason he was such a big star. He was a real man, and he had real appeal. And so, I mean, although I'm sure he realized it would be his last picture, and I certainly did, it was never discussed. It was just, we just went from day to day, and he'd say, oh, I can't drink anymore, I can't smoke anymore. He said, all the fun's gone. You know, we'd say something like that, but other than that, no.
Frank Sinatra, no.
Well,
here's my question. It's not a very personal one, but you almost got married, or I mean, a gossip columnist said that you were engaged. You had been having a relationship, and then after this was in print that you were going to get married,
that was the end.
Yeah,
yes.
He kind of cut off the relationship. So I'm wondering, when someone is as like extraordinary a singer as Frank Sinatra, but you're really angry with that person because of the way they behaved towards you, how does the singing sound? Could you still appreciate his singing, or were you so just really angry at the way he behaved that you couldn't even listen to his records anymore and thought he was, in fact, a lousy singer?
No, I couldn't think he was a lousy singer because he was never a lousy singer. But I was in such a bad, terrible emotional state that I actually didn't want to listen to him very much for that reason. But as for the quality of his work, no. I mean, nobody sounded better than Frank did at that time. Nobody did.
My guest is Lauren Bacall. She's written a new memoir called Now. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lauren Bacall.
A lot of actresses complain that when you stop being a young actress, that the roles dry up. That, you know, for men, there's roles when you get older, you know, like Clint Eastwood could play the leading man.
And how?
And there's no such equivalent for women. And is that something you've felt through your career?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. It's not only age, because a lot of younger actresses cannot find work. They cannot find parts to play. First of all, they're not being written now. Second of all, you have men like Clint Eastwood, who I am crazy about, I must say. He plays in pictures with 20-year-old girls. But a woman can't do that. A woman can't play in a movie with younger guys and have relationships of any kind. Forget it.
When you were young, your hero on screen was Bette Davis.
Yes.
And you even got to meet her and say hello when you were very young.
No, but you see, she had adult roles to play until she had to put an ad in the Hollywood Reporter saying that she was out of work and she was ready and able to go to work.
And then,
shocking that Bette Davis, the greatest star, I think, ever in motion pictures.
Okay, and then some of the roles that she got were these kind of perverse, demonic older women roles. Like Baby Jane, you know, she was just like a horror. And, you know,
wonderful actress.
So I'm wondering, like, here she was, your model when she was younger. What did you think of her as a model for, you know, as an older actress?
Well, I must say that I always loved her. And I think that she, for me, was the best actress and the most exciting female star on the screen. I think her work will live forever. I think it's timeless. And as she got older, her talent did not diminish. I mean, whatever happened to Baby Jane, whatever, it was a wonderful job of acting that she did. She looked like a fright, but that was the part. But she could convey almost anything. She was quite extraordinary talent. And unfortunately, she didn't have an opportunity to do as much as she wanted to. But she was a woman who had to work. And I understand that better than most people do, that you have to work.
Well, your mother was a woman who had to work,
absolutely,
too. So you grew up with that as a model.
I grew up with that. Was the work ethic was very high on our list in our household. I mean, my uncle was a lawyer and my other uncle was a lawyer. Everyone in my family worked. And that's the way we were brought up and I was brought up. And I'm glad I was.
In your first film, smoking was such an important part of the role.
Oh, right? I know, it was so dramatic, too.
Oh, yes.
So effective.
Oh, absolutely.
And romantic.
And then your husband, Humphrey Bogart, died of lung cancer.
That's right.
And you continued to smoke, I think, till 1986.
Tell me about it. No, well, I mean, because you just don't believe that it's going to happen, you know. Hopefully it won't.
Was smoking off-screen dramatic in any way for you,
oh,
like
absolutely.
It was on-screen?
Oh, absolutely. Because if there was a pause, you know, in a conversation with anyone, you could always light a cigarette. Or if a man lit a cigarette for you, you could look up. I mean, it's the most dramatic thing in the world. Because it's intimate, it's suggestive, it's... And that's one of the problems with giving it up is that it's very useful. It's,
you know,
a useful tool.
I consider stopping smoking one of the most difficult things I ever did, but I'm thinking,
it
must have been even harder for you because you had it as a dramatic prop in a way that it never would have worked for me.
No, but so you stopped and you didn't. I finally stopped and I gained 20 pounds and I've been unable to lose them.
Oh, I wouldn't have noticed.
Yeah, well, because, you know, your metabolism changes. Everything changes.
So did you miss the drama of it when you stopped?
Oh, yes. And then, I mean, I haven't had a cigarette in 8.5 years now, which is very good. And for 8 years before then, I was stopping and stopped intermittently about 8 times. But the fact is that when I was in Paris this year for Prêt-à-Porter...
Oh, you can't not smoke
I was
in
sitting
Paris.
In the cafe. I tell you how I resisted that, I will never know.
Yeah.
Because more than once I thought, boy, here I am sitting here with this cup of coffee and friends. A few people are lighting up. What if I just had one? And then I get the urge again. And the only thing I can say about it is that once you've broken your pattern, what saved me was that I just stopped thinking about it because I hadn't done it in so long.
Before I let you go, clear up something for me.
Yes.
In To Have and Have Not, I'd always heard, Lauren Bacall's voice is dubbed by Andy Williams.
God, yes.
And then now in Leonard Maltin's movie guidebook, he says that Andy Williams dubbed the songs, but they never used the tape. What is the story?
Yes, well, he's correct, because the story is they did not dub the songs. Howard Hawks feared that I would not hit the notes, the high notes,
mm-hmm.
of How Little We Know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Andy Williams come in and record it,
mm-hmm.
in case I didn't sound, because I was taking singing lessons at Warner Brothers. And they finally, if you listen to the song, you will know that there's no doubt that it's me, because Andy Williams with that beautiful voice, one would have seen the difference immediately. So they did not, he ended up not using it. And that's the true story. So it's only me with my flat baritone.
Would you have been annoyed if the voice were dubbed? Did you try to say to Hawks, don't do it?
Well, I would never say don't do it to Howard Hawks. You're kidding, I was too frightened of him. But I would certainly have preferred to have done it myself, yes. I'm against all the fake stuff. I'm not into that. I would rather, even in my mediocre vocal way, stumble through a song and then mouth the words to somebody else's voice.
Lauren Bacall. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new film, Prêt-à-Porter, which opens next month. Her new memoir is called Now. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, this is Noah Adams from National Public Radio in Washington with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Tom Jelton reports on the latest military situation in Bihać in Bosnia. On the Christmas shopping scene, we'll check on today's business at the Dollar General store in a small coastal town of Virginia. Andre Kudrescu on the Mall of America near Minneapolis. Ann Cooper reports from South Africa on the first shopping center in the Soweto Township. Brian Naylor with more about Newt Gingrich and his plans in Congress. And we'll have a deconstruction of the hit song All I Want to Do, hearing from the poet who wrote the poem from whence the song comes. The poem is called Fun. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Ivan Reitman may not be a household name, but he is one of the most successful directors in Hollywood, and in many ways one of the most influential. With movies like Meatballs, Stripes, and the two Ghostbuster films, he helped invent Bill Murray's comic persona. And then he went to work on Arnold Schwarzenegger, teaming him with Danny DeVito for the 1988 comedy hit Twins. His new movie is another attempt at a Schwarzenegger-DeVito box office winner. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Junior.
It's the highest of high concepts, a movie that can be summed up not in a couple of sentences, but in just 3 words. Arnold Schwarzenegger, pregnant. Given that premise, Reitman could have gone in a number of directions and wound up with an entertaining movie. He could have, for instance, made the King of Macho pregnant, but macho anyway. So, okay, he's fat, he craves pickles, and his nipples are sensitive. You got a problem with that? Or Reitman could have made a variation on the theme best exemplified by Tootsie and worst exemplified, perhaps, by Mrs. Doubtfire, the theme of a louse turned into a better man by discovering his inner woman. But Reitman and his writers, Kevin Wade and Chris Conrad, have chosen a third course, and I'm afraid they've come up with a mess. The idea is that Arnold plays a scientist, yeah, right, who's at work with a fertility doctor played by Danny DeVito on a new and potentially lucrative wonder drug. When the FDA refuses to allow the drug to be tested on women, DeVito comes up with another solution. He has to convince his colleague Schwarzenegger, who's an introvert and a bit of a cold fish, to allow an embryo to be implanted inside him. If the drug makes it grow in that hostile environment, it's a success. DeVito steals an egg from the lab of another fertility doctor, played by Emma Thompson, and pretty soon Arnold is pregnant. So visibly pregnant, in fact, that he has to be hidden away in DeVito's house. But when DeVito wants to attend a pharmaceutical convention to sell the wonder drug, Arnold gets a little clingy.
Oh, Larry, please take me with you.
No. You stay home. Get back in bed and just take it easy.
No, Larry, you don't understand.
I do understand. No.
Please, no. Listen to me.
No, it's bad for business.
I'm pregnant all alone.
Oh, will you stop saying that? Look, you're not pregnant. You got to think of this as an experiment. Well, think of it like you swallowed a piece of gum. Tiny piece. Dentine.
Look, I won't be in your way. I take walks. I disappear. But please, I feel so isolated.
So, there's the real question. Not do you want to watch Arnold be pregnant for 110 minutes, but do you want to watch Arnold whine for 110 minutes? For some misbegotten reason, the filmmakers have chosen to play this movie for everything but laughs. Trying for the Sleepless in Seattle vote, they get a romance going between Arnold and Emma Thompson that has more schmaltz than chemistry. Although Thompson, it must be said, is the one bright light in the movie. Even though the filmmakers have thrown in a lot of murky slapstick to make her seem lovably clumsy, Thompson's ability to project simultaneous intelligence and intimacy shines through. But why make Arnold's character, of all things, pathetic? In this movie, he goes from being sour before pregnancy to being sourer during. He isn't an agile enough actor to make all these scenes of figurative and literal bellyaching funny. In fact, some audiences may find the characterization insulting. According to Reitman, if you take the King of Macho and feminize him, you don't get a kinder, gentler King of Macho, you get a king-size kvetch. And for movie audiences, a king-size dud.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the ideological warfare over what the life of Malcolm X represents. We talk with Professor Michael Eric Dyson about the conflicts in his Malcolm X seminar. And we talk with James Traub about his new book on the open admissions policy at City College in New York. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.